Spotlight Connecticut with Morgan Cunningham, embracing what's fun with Connecticut on WTIC News Talk 1080.
You know, I've always been a fan of Carrie's and some other select country artists and songs as well, but that's not why I went to Nashville necessarily, although that's definitely part of it, right, to check out the music scene. I just wanted to get away. I could have picked any place in the United States, anywhere in the world, honestly, to get away. I just wanted a break for a few days. News can wear on you, right? So I just wanted to get away for a few days, relax, go into my self-imposed news blackout. Why Nashville, though? I had never been there before. Well, I had heard from so many people, in Connecticut even. In Connecticut. There's more of a country following in this state than you would imagine. Really, that is the truth. So I've heard from so many people, Morgan, you got to get to Nashville. And all of these people have had parties there, birthday parties, wedding-related parties, and so on. Finally, October comes around. It's early October. And I had heard from three separate friends that they had just been to Nashville. I said, well, I'm obviously missing out on something here. I really ought to go and check out what Music City is all about. Well, within a few weeks in October, I made the plans, got on the plane, had no idea what to expect. And the very first night that I was there, I found myself at the Grand Ole Opry. For the tickets that I got to that night's show, Carrie Underwood was one of the acts, as well as Old Crow Medicine Show, The Dead South, and some other acts. I'm going to play another one as my bumper song later on, Connie Smith, a classic country singer, going back to the 1960s. She was excellent. And I got this sense right away that so many people who were there from near and far, there were people from Oregon who I met, Iowa, Canada, all of these people, it was a big melting pot of music fans diverging on to the Grand Ole Opry to check out the show for the night. And I found out that this was a group of people, several thousand of us, who just love music and are proud of music history. Everybody there wanted to see one particular act that night or just to go to the cultural landmark that is Grand Ole Opry, which is synonymous with classic music, classic country music specifically, dating back to the 1920s. Then I found myself on Broadway in Nashville. And for those of you who are not initiated, that would be, I don't know, it's like a mile long of just bars, restaurants, and performance venues, and bars that have performance stages and so on that are just known for their music. But my stereotype was that this was all country. And granted, if you go to the Grand Ole Opry, it's like 98% always country. You're going to hear a banjo and a fiddle on the Grand Ole Opry stage. That's just the way it's going to be. But if you go throughout the rest of the city, Broadway included, it's not necessarily country music. And everybody who I had the chance to hear, and you can't go to all of these places, by the way, in just one particular visit or trip. You're going to have to explore this over a longer period of time because some of these bars have 3, 4, 5, 6 floors. And each floor or every other floor has a different act performing on it. So it just is not totally feasible to get a good idea of the acts that are there and playing. But the acts that I did hear are just as good as those that are signed to a major label. And my favorite act on Broadway was actually not a country act. It was a rock band. They did some classic rock. They did some metal. They did some punk rock. They did some country rock. And they were a cover group. Primarily, they had a few originals. I was just blown away by the amount of music that there was truly in Music City that was not just country music. So if you ever hear from people that Nashville is America's new party city, I would agree with them on that, number one. But number two, I would encourage you to check it out because there really is something there for everybody. I also caught a Christmas show and they were doing, I thought, this was me going down there. I had expected to hear country Christmas music. Nope. They did jazz arrangements, and they were all very, very good and extremely talented dancers as well for that particular show, which was actually a showboat that took you up the Cumberland River, and you got to see all the neons. They don't call them city lights. They're neon lights in downtown Nashville, 14-mile river ride. And that was just mind-blowingly beautiful and inspiring in its own way. But I would tell you to check out Nashville if you can. The people are very friendly, and they're inviting. The music, certainly if you want to take in music, you're going to find a genre that you like. I would also encourage you to leave Nashville. I went to East Tennessee. Didn't quite know what to expect there because of Hurricane Helene that came in and caused a lot of damage in that region. I did not see any of that damage. I'm not saying that it wasn't there because I didn't go that far into East Tennessee, but I was a good distance into East Tennessee where I had the opportunity to explore a cavern. Tennessee is also known not just for music and whiskey, but also for caverns. So they will actually take you, if you're lucky enough and you do your research and you find the right place, they'll take you into a cave for a tour. So I found myself about 330 feet under Earth's surface in a cavern. And it was not as scary as you would think. And it wasn't as confined as you would think. Overall, great experience. My first trip to Nashville most certainly will not be my last. So add me to the list of folks from Connecticut who are a big fan of Tennessee, namely Nashville. You know what else I'm a fan of? Good chocolate. And we have a number of great options in Connecticut for local chocolatiers that make chocolate candies. Not necessarily Hershey's, Reese's. I mean, they're all good, right? But I'm talking about homegrown chocolate. Well, Fosh's Chocolates is in Waterbury. They were on my show about 2 years ago for a general introduction into their history, what they're all about, kind of how chocolate is made. And then earlier this year, about May, I started to become aware of a chocolate shortage in the news, a lack of cocoa that's being produced along the world's equator, which is primarily where cocoa is produced, largely in Africa. They're responsible for the bulk of chocolate, cocoa, for the whole world. And I said to myself, well, gee, what's this going to do? Is this going to result in barren shelves at the store? Well, that hasn't happened, at least not yet. There's still plenty of chocolate out there, so people might not say, well, there's a shortage. But there actually has been a lack of cocoa production due to a number of reasons. Geopolitical reasons, some corruption perhaps in some rogue African countries. You also have environmental issues that are impacting cocoa. So at the store, you're able to find chocolate, but your wallet is paying a lot more. And it's not necessarily due to inflation, but is because of this problem in finding, in growing, in producing cocoa. So I set out to find a number of different producers to talk with them about it. And many were tight-lipped. They didn't want to tell me anything. And obviously, for marketing reasons, they don't want to sound bad at all because of, well, aren't chocolates expensive and it's because of a shortage. Well, that's not great for marketing, right? But I also believe that customers have the right to know what is actually going on with the products that they're buying. And the first chocolate company to openly blow the whistle on this was World's Finest Chocolates out of Chicago. I've bought some chocolates from them before. They're known primarily for fundraisers, but since COVID, they've actually opened up so that individuals can actually buy the chocolate bars that they make. And they sent out a letter to their past clients, myself included, saying that because of this chocolate shortage, we have focused on our most popular items and not our other items, and we have had to raise prices because of this issue. They were the first ones to openly admit it that I could actually find. Then I came across our good friend, Carmen Romeo, of Fosh's Chocolates in Waterbury, Connecticut. And he said, you know what, Morgan? I'm going to come on and I'm going to talk about that. So the rest of this hour, it's all about chocolate, what you need to know, what's happening in the industry, why are prices up, and are we running out?
This is WTIC in Hartford.
I'm Morgan Cunningham at Spotlight Connecticut. And today, everybody's favorite topic, except for one person. I did know one person in my life who was not actually a fan of chocolate. Can you believe that? Not milk, not dark, not white. Although she did like hot cocoa. Okay, so I guess that qualifies, maybe, kind of, sort of. But for everybody else, people just love their chocolate. They have seen prices increase. Maybe they have seen the headlines. A lot of the reporting was done out of England about some issues in chocolate production, particularly in this past year. And we're going to dig into that issue with Waterbury's own Fosh's Chocolates and their owner, Carmen Romeo. Carmen, who's also, may I add, a big fan of WTIC. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Morgan. Good to be here.
Tell everybody, Carmen, how you got into the chocolate business, because it wasn't actually something that you've done your entire life, your entire career.
Not at all. So I was born and raised in Waterbury and left when I went to college, and I'd never heard of this little chocolate business called Fascia's Chocolates, which had pretty much started around the year I was born, 60 years ago. I came back to Connecticut in 1994 after being away for a bunch of years, and I met my wife, who is Louise, the eldest of the three Fascia daughters. So, and one of the first things she tells me is my family has a chocolate business in Waterbury, which I had never heard of. Well, 18 months later, we get married, and I'm very well steeped in what Fascia's Chocolates is and its great products and all of that. But I was still working in my chosen career. I'm an engineer by training, and at the time I was working for GE, and I moved my wife away for another bunch of years with my career. Well, we ended up back in Connecticut in the early 2000s, and found myself in 2008 with my in-laws still working the business. They suddenly were forced to move. They basically, at ages 69 and 73, got a lease notice that their building was sold, and they had 2 months to move. So that was a shock and a big deal, because when you're in the family, you are in the business, even though still at that moment, it wasn't my livelihood. But within about 6 months later, the company I was running, which was a manufacturing company in Torrington, we had made a decision, myself, with the ownership in the Midwest, that we were going to move the business to the Midwest. And at that point, I began talking to my wife about maybe we should be in the chocolate business. And she was pretty reluctant, having grown up with it. And at the size of the business was, it certainly wasn't an easy transition financially. But we came into the business, and that is how I became an engineer turned chocolatier.
I have to give it to you, because you have classes about how chocolate is made, how it's produced in Waterbury at Fascia's factory. In fact, you've got windows where you can see people making the candies right before your own very eyes. And I think that that's something special about you, because as I've been kind of digging into this issue of some kind of a chocolate shortage going on in the world, there have not been a lot of producers that have been willing to talk about it, obviously for marketing reasons, and maybe it sounds bad for them and they don't want to let out their secrets. And yet you're very forthcoming, you're honest, you want your clients and people to know what goes into chocolate.
Well, I believed long ago that we should demystify the world of chocolate. And yes, you're right, we've been here in the building we're in today, which is our final home, but we moved in about 12 years ago. I have now spoken to over 60,000 people about the history and origins of chocolate, and then what we do with it. So part of the demystification is to talk about the supply chain and the fact that, yeah, we are a chocolatier, a confectioner. It's kind of a class. But the world of chocolate, really, if you look at what they call standard industry classification codes. The government uses codes to classify every business. And if you look at the chocolate codes, there's essentially two: makes chocolate from a bean and makes confections from chocolate. And most of the household names out there fall into that second category, which is we buy chocolate and we do things with it. I like to talk about the wonderful things Fascia's does with our chocolate, which is a very high grade, high-end chocolate. So we buy a good product and we make it better. You're right. There are a lot of confectioners out there who, go through pains. They may not lie, but they certainly don't give you the whole story. And you think that they're the ones sourcing the beans out in the jungles of Costa Rica or Western Africa. And no, I kind of demystify that whole thing. I name names. When you're here, I name names and really tell everybody who's doing what. And I feel like that's the better way to go, because what ends up standing out is, again, how we do it here, what we do with it afterwards here, and why we think that creates, and why we're told all the time, that creates a superior product. It's the old-fashioned, handmade way. But But the process and what you started with, the supply chain and what's happening in the world, you know, that's out of our control. It's out of anybody's real control. But it's a fascinating, very interesting, and very complicated thing.
Well, very complicated indeed. That's why we're going to spend the whole hour on this. We do have a break coming up in just a few minutes. But I'm just looking here, Carmen, at some general headlines. Decoding the global chocolate crisis. A hotter climate threatens chocolates. Chocolate prices to sharply rise in coming months, etc. Okay, this just goes on and on and on. What's happening here?
So part of it is climate, but not so much climate change as people would want to jump to. The earth getting warmer is certainly an issue. We're not going to talk about, you know, that. That's a fact. It's happening. But in the case of cacao, that's the plant. Theobroma cacao is Latin for fruit of the gods. And that's the name given to it long ago. But cacao grows in hot, wet areas. You must be within 20 degrees north or south of the equator in order to grow, and very wet. About 70% of our world's cacao grows in Western Africa, with Ghana and the Ivory Coast each about 30%. They kind of go back and forth with who produced the most each year. And then about 20% from Central and South America. And that's for cocoa, for going into chocolate. So what's happening is El Nino and La Nina, these two patterns, which for, you know, for eons have been around the earth and producing either wet or dry conditions, those are conspiring. And we're in a pattern now where it's been a little bit too dry. And we've had three straight years of crop deficits compared to what the world wants out of the Western African continent, Ghana, Ivory Coast specifically. So you have a natural phenomena not allowing the beans to grow as well. But it's compounded a bit by government and people. So I can go on. I know you have a break, so I want to not keep talking if you have a break.
Well, let's dig into the political issue when we get back from the break, because that in itself is definitely fascinating. Where are some other parts in the world that might be making up for this chocolate issue? I mean, if it's mostly coming from Africa and Central America, you know, there's another 50% elsewhere. Is it just basically along the equator, wherever it's kind of that warm climate?
Yes, anywhere within 20 degrees north or south of the equator and wet. So again, 70% from Western Africa today, 20% from Central and South America, but that is where we're going to get more of our cacao, more in Central and South America. Actually, Brazil happens to be one of the places where investments are going in. The problem is you can't immediately make this change. Cacao trees take 7 years to produce fruit, and
we've only got a few years to go left on those Brazils,
then,
right?
Yeah, 7 years. Yeah, so they've been doing... There have been more and more investments being made over the last 2 to 3 to 4 years, but that means we still have 3 to 4 years to go to see anything that's going to move the needle. So you know, it's worldwide consumption too that keeps going up. So as the prices go up, prices going up tends to tamp down demand. So it's, you know, that's kind of the pattern we're in right now.
Definitely an equilibrium there. I'm Morgan Cunningham at Spotlight Connecticut. Carmen Romeo of Fasha's Chocolates. Check them out online and on social media, too. Find me on socials at MC News Talk. Our bumpers today inspired by my trip to Nashville. Here's a classic country singer. Connie Smith, saw her last week at the Grand Ole Opry. Morgan Cunningham with you on Spotlight Connecticut. Find me on socials at MC News Talk. You can also find Fasha's Chocolates on social media and online as well. My guest, Carmen Romeo, he is the president of Fasha's. And fun story, Carmen, as we get back from the break, we talk about the chocolate shortage and the politics of it that is going to be the next focus of our chat going on in our world today. I did get a message from our very reliable listener, Bill in Plainville. They say that there's this rule, you don't do shout-outs in talk radio, but I don't care. Bill in Plainville, hello to you. I guess he was just so happening to be driving through Waterbury and stopped in at Fasha's and got himself a little treat.
That was wonderful. I wasn't even out front. I was talking to you, but amazing story and good coincidence. We're right off the highway. It's so easy to find if you're traveling 84. We're just 2 miles north on Route 8 and immediately off the highway on the banks of the Naugatuck River. So very, very easy to find.
You also do tours there as well, right?
Absolutely. So we do what we call a chocolate experience. It's our main thing, and that's an hour-long presentation where people make a chocolate bar and listen to me talk a lot about chocolate and how we do things here and a little history of our of Fascia. So that is usually on Saturdays during this time of the year, although we'll sprinkle in as we get into the holiday break. There will be like between Christmas and New Year's on that Friday, Thursday and Friday after Christmas. Anytime there's a school vacation. And then during the summer, we're throughout the week as well. There are public chocolate experiences. However, we do lots of things with senior groups. In fact, this morning already, I had a senior group from East Hartford down. And then we had our public chocolate experience. I've already done two events today. And we have school groups, senior groups, special needs groups of all kinds coming in.
You're very honest about chocolate, hence why you're on the show. And before the break, we were talking about this global chocolate crisis, whatever you want to call it. I don't know what you would call it, Carmen, but we were talking about environment impacting it, and we were starting to talk about the politics impacting it. Is this a crisis? Would you classify it as a crisis?
Yes and no. I mean, yeah, prices have gone up and we'll talk about the politics and gone and, you know, there will be a chocolate supply. It's just a matter of, you know, how much you want to pay for it. So if that's a crisis to some people, yes, to some people, they'll pay anything to get their chocolate. Here at Fascia's, we'll kind of go backwards, but here at Fascia's, we experienced a 60% price increase in what we pay for chocolate in June, and we spent most of July and August kind of scratching our heads and figuring out, you know, how long things took to make, because although the chocolate price was a big piece, labor is a big piece, packaging, and our price increase averaged somewhere between 11 and 12%, on a 60% price chocolate increase. And I still think we're in line with, you know, the better chocolates that are out there. I know we are in line in terms of price, but, you know, people haven't really said anything about the price increase. So I wouldn't call it a crisis yet. There's enough to go around.
But definitely an increase in prices because of the factors that are happening really outside of our hands. And part of that is political in Africa.
That's correct. So as I mentioned before, each Ghana and the Ivory Coast each produce somewhere close to 30% of the world's cacao. The farmers there, keep in mind, in Ghana alone, there's about 1 million farms. The average size is about 2 acres and a couple hundred trees, and that's it. They each produce, each farmer, each average little farm may produce a ton to 2 tons of cacao pod, of seed, you know, cacao beans a year. Now, consider that you need 40 pods to make 1 pound of chocolate. I mean, a ton or 2 tons of chocolate is really a very small drop in the bucket. But these farmers are living in, you know, they're in the third world country. The prices that they get paid are determined by the government. The Ghanaian government fixes a price that they're going to pay the farmer to produce a ton of beans, and then they then sell it. So they're the ones who are the ones who sell, if you will, the chocolate futures. So if you want to buy, you can bid on chocolate. It's a commodity, just like wheat, just like oil, as people hear about the barrel of oil going up and going down. The same thing with cacao. There's futures out there. And that's where the sometimes speculation comes in. So what happened, a ton of beans traditionally over the last literally 5 years was fluctuated, but never really exceeded over $3,000 a ton. That's just a rough number, but that's about what it held for the last several bunch of years. Well, in the spring, 1 ton of chocolate was trading for over $10,000 a ton. That's over three times wow. that had been trading for a year prior. Now, some of that was speculation, where those investors who buy and hold the futures and then resell them when they get higher because, you know, the people see the prices are rising. But and that was part of it, but a lot of it was really, truly the supply of beans. I'll get back to the political part, but people should know that beans around the equator, you don't really have seasons, but according to our season, cacao is picked generally, the majority of the cacao crop happens around October, November, our late fall, and then also in spring, February, March. There's two crops a year that these trees grow. And that last October, November of 2023 is when they saw a very high weakening. You know, there wasn't as much yield coming out of the jungles of Ghana and Ivory Coast. And that turns into something they call cocoa grind. I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but that's how much how many beans are turned into chocolate, essentially, worldwide. And that's about February, March is when the prices started really spiking, when they had a sense of what the year's crop would be. And that's, again, what turned into our price increase that happened back in June. The politics of it, though, is, again, the Ghanaian government and the Ivory Coast government, they're the ones controlling how much the farmer gets paid, and they're the ones making the money on selling the beans. And, you know, they're betting a little bit, too. They can't sell too much of the crop if it doesn't develop. And that's basically where the El Nino, La Nina, if there is a, you know, a drought and the trees don't produce enough, then they're the ones on the hook. And that's another where prices can go crazy. The other problem is that the farmers are not incentivized. If they're getting a fixed price for beans, no matter what, they're not incentivized to use pesticides or fertilizer, which could make a huge difference. There are some crop diseases that are naturally occurring, but if they occur, some blight, that would actually could wipe out literally a whole we call them a plantation, but again, a small family farm, can wipe out their whole crop. So the farmer's totally subject potentially to this blight, and they don't have pesticides to fight it because they don't have the money. The government should be the one, you would think, if they're the ones controlling the prices and they're the ones paying the money, they should also be trying to get those crops better by using fertilizers and pesticides, and that's not happening. Everything I just talked about is happening in places like Costa Rica and Ecuador and Brazil, where it's a little bit more of a capitalistic market.
Do you think that they are intentionally taking advantage of the demand that exists for chocolate? We know that it's strong. You've also argued that since COVID, people have kind of viewed it as one of the little luxuries of life that you do have control over, and that was particularly in the pandemic, but that has certainly continued 4 years later.
Absolutely. So do I think they're intentionally? Probably not. The Ghanaian government, you know, I mentioned they're not providing fertilizers and pesticides. Well, with 50% inflation over there because of governmental issues, they can't even borrow the money to, you know, it's a vicious cycle. So I don't think they are. If they could produce more, I think they would be happy to produce more. I think there's a vicious cycle happening there. As far as the resiliency and the people, yeah, COVID, if anything, demand went up when people were home and decided that they wanted, you know, their comforts, and chocolate happened to be one of them.
That it was. I know I've been addicted to chocolate in the last few years. I blame COVID. I do. It has not helped with my size. Let's put it that way. Well, anyway, Carmen.
Honestly, the other thing that is also happening is, you know, the Europeans have always been the highest, you know, per capita in terms of consumption per person. But as middle classes develop in India and China, that is a huge population that is coming on line, if you will, to buy and want chocolate. So really, U.S. consumption is actually small compared to the consumption growth that's happening out of the Indian and the Chinese populations. So that's another big thing. That's why demand is so far up, is those populations are getting a little more money, a little bit more of a middle class happening, and they're going after chocolate as well.
I'm Morgan Cunningham at Spotlight Connecticut, and my guest is Carmen Romeo. He is the president of Fasha's Chocolates in Waterbury. When we get back from the break, the big question that I've gotten from a number of people, and somebody in New Hartford listening just sent me a message and said, what can be done about this? Can it be grown in the U.S.?
This is WTIC in Hartford.
Bob listening in New Hartford. Good old Bob. He's out there. And he is not shy, let's put it that way. When he's got a question, he lets me know. When he likes a show, he lets me know. When he hates a show, he lets me know. So today he seems to be engaged and interested. And Carmen Romeo, the owner of Fasha's Chocolates in Waterbury, his question is simple. He wants to know what can be done in the United States about what might be a growing chocolate crisis around the world. Can we grow cocoa here in the United States, at the very least, in a controlled environment, or if things continue to get warmer over the course of many years, you know, can it be grown in Florida, Georgia, somewhere down south? What's your answer to that, Carmen?
Short answer is yes. It certainly can be grown in a greenhouse. Anybody who's ever taken the ride at Epcot around the train, and there's some cacao plants there, trees growing cacao pods. So it can be done, but the amount of the warmth and the amount of water that's required does not make large-scale greenhouse growing. And again, these are trees that produce just a few pods, multiple pods, but you know, it would take many, many trees. As I mentioned, you know, in Ghana, you know, an average farm is a couple acres, a couple hundred trees, and they're only producing about a ton to 2 tons of cacao. So it's not a very highly dense product. Now, technically, we are growing chocolate in the United States. That would be in Hawaii on the southern end of the Big Island. That's kind of in that temperate zone. It's kind of like a mini rainforest. And there is cacao growing there. There's just not enough acreage to really make a dent. The majority of the investment that's been going in by these large companies who do the making of chocolate has been happening in Brazil, the northern part of Brazil, which is, again, in that 20-degree climate area. And so that's where a lot of it's going to be. Again, we talked about the trees. They need time to grow. Your question about global warming, though, is interesting, and that is yes. I mean, over time, that 20-degree zone would widen, theoretically. Nobody listening to this program, or none of the grandchildren of anybody listening to this program, would ever, you know, we won't get there that soon.
Okay, well, it might happen many, many years in the future. And maybe then it will be feasible to do so in the United States. Maybe not. I don't know if we have the space necessarily.
They grew grapes in Greenland, didn't they? Somewhere.
That's true.
They did. So, yeah.
Well, that's definitely true. Well, what could we expect in the next year? Do you expect that prices will stabilize more? Do you think that they're going to drop at least to where they were before May, June of this year?
They will not drop anytime really soon. Because again, it's going to take several seasons. If we see a weather pattern change, indications are now that the crop is strong, maybe not enough to give us surpluses, but it's stronger this fall as they're picking. Most of the speculators are out of the commodity market. It's reached its high. Nobody's buying cacao now at, you know, $8,000-$9,000 a ton, $7,000-$8,000 a ton. They're not buying it to see it run back up. So I think the only people in the market right now are the serious users. I don't expect any movement in chocolate prices up or down, really. I think we hit the max. These big growers, these big makers have bought enough beans, and they're buying enough beans, and they're blending beans from year to year. So which is why 300% increase turned into a 60% increase in chocolate. They're also trying to smooth things over. I do hope that a few years from now, the prices would start to ease back down.
Well, Carmen, we are just about plumb out of time. And the first thing I want to do is thank you for being honest and candid Because as I had mentioned earlier, a number of chocolate producers are kind of secretive about this stuff and this process, and you're laying it all out for people to know and hear, and I can say that I appreciate that, and I'm sure chocolate fans listening across Connecticut and wherever else they may be streaming the show, I'm sure they appreciate it as well. So thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. I love talking about it. They come to our chocolate experience and learn even more.
How can people find you online, Carmen, at Fosha's?
You can find us at FoschasChocolates.com, but that's too hard to spell. So the shortcut to that is FASCHOC, FastChalk.com. That's our website. And then Fosha's Chocolates or Fosh Chalk is also on Facebook and Instagram. We don't tweet or X very much.
All right. Well, Carmen, and I can say, as having been there, you gave me a tour one-on-one. It really is fascinating, and you learn a lot about what you eat, not just chocolate from Fosha's, but as you say, you look at it from an industry perspective. Well, thanks for coming on the show this afternoon.
You are more than welcome, Morgan. I'm going to make a five-second plug and say, if you want your holiday chocolates, you do not have to wait till Christmas. They're good now for Christmas. So come on down in the next 3 weeks. We only have three to four weeks before we hit Christmas.
Can you believe that?
Not at all. It's crazy.
Definitely is. I'm Morgan Cunningham. Next week, we are going to continue our celebration of WTIC's March toward 100 years of broadcasting, if you could believe it. Our guest will be Ray Dunaway for next hour. Yo, he's a hoot. We just love Ray around here.
Spotlight Connecticut with Morgan Cunningham, embracing what's fun with Connecticut on WTIC News Talk 1080.